The Colorado Rockies are 12-20, having won four games in a row. Herman Marquez ends up needing Tommy John surgery. The future of televised baseball is changing. And let's talk Justin Lawrence, Pierce Johnson, Brent Suter, Elias Diaz, and Ezekiel Tovar again. Welcome to Adjusting for Altitude.
Baseball is a difficult game. The average hitter gets on base in less than 40% of their plate appearances. Yet the average pitcher gives up four runs every nine innings pitched. The sport is a challenge on its own. But in altitude, the problems for baseball players compound. Less break on pitches, balls that fly significantly farther than at sea level, and then after playing in such a treacherous environment, the players play in normality for half of their regular season. Adjustments must be made by those who don the purple pinstripes of the Colorado Rockies. We discuss those adjustments here. This is Adjusting for Altitude with baseball fanatic and aspiring MLB general manager, Christopher Nelson II.
Welcome, welcome. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever or whenever you're listening to this episode. This is Adjusting for Altitude, breaking down the unique challenges and difficulties faced by the only Major League Baseball team that plays a mile above sea level, streaming on all podcasting platforms across the World Wide Web. I am your host, Christopher Nelson II. If you haven't checked out last week's episode, I'd significantly urge you to do so. It was a good one. It was the first official episode where I felt semi-comfortable with the new format put in place. We're actually going to get to the heart of the issues that this podcast was created to get to the heart of. Go check it out. We cover some pretty interesting players, and it was just a good time. Go do that after you listen to this episode, of course, or before, if you like to hear episodes that were released beforehand, before listening to newer ones. Also, go follow me on social media if you haven't already. I do believe this is my username across social media platforms, but I really only use Instagram these days. I am the second is where you can find me there. IamThaSecond. Other than that, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Adjusting for Altitude. Now, the Rockies have actually gotten their act together, believe it or not. I have no idea why. I will preface that. I have no idea why they have decided to finally get their act together, but it seems like they have been. Four straight wins for the first time this season. Fun fact, not even the St. Louis Cardinals have won four straight games this season, but that's a whole other conversation in and of itself. They are actually worse than the Colorado Rockies are at this point in time right now. They're the worst team in the National League. But aside from that, it seems like after getting blown out on Saturday, the Rockies actually decided to, play good baseball. Hopefully this is not something that's going to end up just fading away in like a few games or so. And this actually is a trend that's maintained, but it was good to see. It's good to see. So in honor of the Colorado Rockies winning four games in a row, as of me recording this, obviously I'm recording on a Thursday. This is the fourth of May. Rockies actually did play a game today. They usually don't play on Thursdays, but they played today. They played today afternoon. And they won. That was their fourth straight win. Usually that's not the case, but I figured I'd include it because why not? I'm recording this after the game is done, so it fits right in. But in addition to it being a Thursday where the Colorado Rockies played a baseball game and won their fourth straight baseball game, it's also your host's birthday. I know, a very, very special episode. Today, I have officially completed an Andrew Jackson's worth of revolutions around the sun. 20 of them things have been completed. I know. Thank you for all the props for just simply existing for 20 years. I know. It's amazing. So I figured I'd throw that in there. But with that said, let's just hop into the episode, shall we? What's been going on?
The Colorado Rockies are a Major League Baseball organization with many happenings and occurrences. Chris, what's been going on?
So I don't know why that was delayed briefly for a second, but I guess my computer decided to take it a little easier today since it's my birthday, and it figured I'd have a little bit more leeway. Whatever the case may be, I did promise on last episode, and I'm a man of my word, I did promise on last week's episode that I would get back to you all on what it officially means when a ball club designates a player for assignment, seeing that both Jose Ureña and Ty Block were designated for assignment by the Colorado Rockies last week or over the last week and a half. I don't know if Ureña was designated exactly a week ago, maybe a little bit beforehand. Nonetheless, here is how Major League Baseball defines being designated for assignment. When a player's contract is designated for assignment, often abbreviated DFA, that player is immediately removed from his club's 40-man roster, and within 7 days of the transaction, the player can be either traded or placed on irrevocable outright waivers, meaning effectively that that player cannot be recovered by the team that DFA'd them. If the player is claimed off of said waivers by another club, he is immediately added to that team's 40-man roster, at which point he can be optioned to the minor leagues if he has minor league options remaining on his contract, or assigned to his new team's 26-man roster, just promoting him to the major league club outright. If the player clears waivers, he may be sent outright to the minor leagues or released. Players with more than 3 years of Major League Baseball service time or who have been previously outrighted may reject the outright assignment in favor of free agency. Interesting. So I figured it had to do with the club executing the DFA, just saying that this is a player that we don't want anymore, but it's actually cool to see that this is what this term actually means. It effectively means not only do we not want you anymore, but we really don't see any spot for you within our organization. Of course, if that player enters free agency and rejects the outright, it's possible they could re-sign with the team, but I don't think that would be the case if they'd already rejected the outright directly. But nonetheless, there you go. That's what it means to be designated for assignment. I hope you're happy. I know I certainly am. It's always fun to learn things. You learn something new every day. In other news, Germán Márquez had Tommy John surgery. Well, I don't know if he's had it yet, but he's going to need to have had it at some point before the end of the year. This does mean that Germán is done for the season, as that's not a surgery that's very quick and easy to recover from. I mean, you can ask someone like Tyler Kinley, but for whatever reason, like 2013, 2014 Rockies roster popped into my head. I don't know why. Nonetheless, Germán's probably done for the season. He's going to be in the same boat as Lucas Gilbreth. Very, very unfortunate. And it's even more unfortunate considering that just a week ago, it seemed like he wasn't going to need Tommy John surgery, as the initial report suggested that it was more of a tricep related issue above the shoulder. Remember me reporting on that last week. So it's kind of disappointing to see that, in fact, Germán will need Tommy John surgery, that is close enough to that ulnar collateral ligament that it's going to just need to happen in order for him to be a major league pitcher in the future. Other injuries to note. Denelson Lamet was moved to the injured list, I believe retroactive to yesterday or the day before, with lower back stiffness. Now, he's really not been very good over his last few performances, quite honestly at all. I think he's thrown something like one or two innings and given up 9 runs. Not been good. He has not been able to find the strike zone. I think we talked about that briefly last week. I do believe that I did say last week as well that he has the potential to be a solid arm in the bullpen if he can get that command under control, and that control under control, and just trust his deception with that motion that he possesses. But nonetheless, you can't do that with a stiff back. So he's on the IL. Peter Lambert was recalled from Albuquerque, where he's been fine. I believe the stats were that he started 5 games and has like a 4.26 ERA. It's all right. Not too bad from a guy coming off of Tommy John surgery himself. So it'll be interesting to see what capacity the Rockies use him in over the next few weeks. I think it's going to be long relief in all likelihood, with Antonio Senzatella having made a few rehab appearances and maybe being slated to return sometime soon. So we'll see how that whole rotational mumble jumble plays out in the end. But there you go. Márquez will need Tommy John surgery, and Denelson Lamet is on the IL with Peter Lambert being recalled from AAA. But I want to get into a more interesting topic. And I know I'm spending a little bit more time on this segment of the podcast than I usually do, but there's something interesting that I came across the other day on TikTok. Now, I know TikTok is not usually the place that's known for being the most notable haven of a wealth of information that one could possibly access on the planet Earth. But I actually found, or I came across a video rather on my For You page that was actually pretty interesting. And I do think it will impact the Colorado Rockies going forward, as well as many other Major League Baseball clubs, as it already has impacted the Phoenix Suns in the NBA. So this is a video I found. Let's go take a listen. The account's name, I'll find you the account's name in a second, I guess. But here's the video. It's effectively about the interesting trends as it pertains to regional sports networks and providing sports maybe for free to fans across the United States, maybe even internationally, but for the, in the United States, definitely. Here we go. This is what the Phoenix Suns have been up to, if you haven't heard about this already.
The Phoenix Suns just decided to lose tens of millions of dollars a year on purpose, but this decision could end up making them the most popular and profitable team in the NBA. You see, since the 70s, NBA games have been on cable, which means if you wanted to watch your favorite team play, you had to sign up for an expensive monthly cable bundle. But this setup was beneficial for both the teams and the networks that broadcast the game, because the teams got paid tens of millions of dollars a year for their media rights, and regional sports networks like Fox Sports and later Bally Sports could essentially force people to pay for their channel because there was no other way to watch the game. And even as streaming rose to prominence, these regional sports networks got a special deal where local fans were blacked out from streaming the games the regional sports networks already had the rights to, further forcing fans to use their service. But recently, people are ditching cable, and regional sports networks are actually losing money. So much so, in fact, that Bally Sports actually filed for bankruptcy back in March, which means that this decades-long, mutually beneficial partnership between the teams and the networks no longer exists, since it's been reported that Bally is actually missing payments to its teams across the NBA and MLB. So if teams aren't getting paid for the rights to their games anymore, what incentive do they have to keep working with these restrictive regional sports networks? Well, the answer is there really isn't one, which is why the Suns have started what I assume will be a trend of broadcasting and streaming their games for free for local fans. The team's new owner, Matt Ishbia, who bought the team at a $4 billion valuation in February, has said he's willingly passing up on $10 plus million in annual broadcasting deals in favor of airing the games for free over local TV channels and through a new team-branded streaming service. It's estimated by the team that this decision will make Suns games available in over three times more households in Arizona, up from 800,000 to more than 2.8 million. And for Ishbia, that's the whole goal, getting the team in front of more people. Because as he points out, when more people watch the games on TV, more people feel connected to the team and will be willing to spend money on merchandise and tickets. But beyond that, by tripling the potential viewership for the team, they can now demand more on in-stadium sponsorships and ads. And if they were to just increase the revenue in each of these areas by 5 to 10%, they would undoubtedly make the money back they're losing on a potential deal with Bally Sports. Finally, a win-win that actually involves the fans. The Phoenix...
Exactly. So, again, shout out to Tyler. That's the guy's name. Over on TikTok, he seems like a pretty cool guy. Kind of covers some sports and the business aspect as well of the sporting industry. His at is at Tyler, T-Y-L-E-R, dot M dot W-E-B-B. On TikTok. I don't know if he's got that username across other social media platforms as well. But shout out to Tyler for that for sure, because that brings up a very interesting point. The way that sports streaming is changing is really interesting, and it's making it really difficult for regional sports networks to stay in business primarily through cable. Like, for instance, you can go find a streaming service such as DirecTV, or I guess that'd be a cable service in this perspective. You can go find a cable service such as a DirecTV, a Comcast, Xfinity, something like that, where you can get all these regional sports channels. But you have to understand that this is really the only place you can find a lot of these regional sports channels. And oftentimes, a lot of these cable channels don't cover all of these channels at the same time, in that they don't have a package that offers all of them at the same time. So, like, for instance, there are a lot of local cable networks within the Denver metro area, Colorado as a whole, that don't offer both Altitude Sports and AT&T Sportsnet. So you can't watch both Rockies games and Nuggets and Avalanche games. You have to pick which networks you want. And it's interesting to see just how hard it is for regional sports networks to stay in business in this day and age, where we're seeing such a trend in streaming usage increasing, right? People are kind of ditching those cable networks in favor of cheaper streaming options, such as a Fubo TV or a YouTube TV. These regional sports networks are going to be hanging in just by a thread, honestly, as we heard in that video. Bally Sports filed for bankruptcy. I think AT&T Sportsnet finds themselves in a similar situation, if I recall, in that they're only going to be obligated to stream Rockies content throughout the rest of the season, in addition to their other affiliates across the U.S. So I think that's the Mariners, the Pirates, and the Astros, I believe, as well, who are on the AT&T Sportsnet system. I could be mistaken. But nonetheless, those networks are starting to struggle financially, and it's very apparent, even in the fees that they charge. Like, for instance, FuboTV's highest package, the package that they offer that's of the highest value and the highest price, is set at $85 a month. Not too bad, considering all things involved. But then when you go to the checkout, you notice that it conveniently raises to about $100 a month, maybe like $102 and then a few cents. So from $85 a month to $100 a month at checkout, that's not, it's a pretty substantial difference. Most of that is regional sports network fees, right? Altitude Sports is the regional sports network that Fubo has mainstreamed, that they carry, and they've used it as a selling point for customers within the Denver metro area to be able to watch those Nuggets and Avs games that they can't watch on cable channels. It's just going to show that how much these regional sports companies have to charge in order to stay afloat. And I don't think they'll be able to stay afloat for long. But the idea of a Matt Ishbia, the new owner of the Phoenix Suns, using his platform for the benefit of not only himself financially, but the team financially and the fans practically being able to watch their team for free is absolutely incredible. It's the idea of conscious capitalism, using the free market system to not only benefit yourself by using very individual or individualistic ideas and pursuits to grow one's wealth, but growing one's wealth by using other methods that will function just as efficiently, if not more efficiently, than the individualistic ones, and at the same time benefiting other people involved. So huge shout out to Matt Ishbia. I really do hope that other teams start to take note and kind of just open up this market and change the way this market functions in the 21st century to make sports like basketball and baseball more available to the fans that want to watch them. We'll get into the next segment of our show in just 1 second. Stay tuned. Welcome back. Welcome back. It is now time for this week's installment of Five Man Analysis.
Using advanced MLB analytics and eye test comparisons, let's discuss the performance of five Colorado Rockies thus far this season. This is Five Man Analysis.
So before we get into Five Man Analysis on this week's episode, I would like to draw your attention back to a few episodes ago when I said that the adjustment that the Rockies need to take, just from a technical perspective, that just makes too much sense not to do, is opening their stances. I said that there are a few guys in the lineup who are struggling because it seems like they're too closed off in the batter's box. And if they just open their stances a little bit, whether it be with the upper body or even opening the foot, maybe, I don't know if I mentioned the foot previously, but that is another way to open up your batting stance. Just opening the stance in some regard would significantly improve their confidence at the dish and their production as well, as we've seen so far with guys like Elias Diaz, who since opening their stance from the first week or so of the season have absolutely thrived. And we're actually going to cover Elias in more depth on today's episode, but it's interesting to see that the Rockies have actually taken note of this. Now, I don't know if it's because they heard me say this or if it's because our hitting coaches are actually observing the things that I'm observing as well by watching the games on TV, but guys like Chris Bryant have opened their stance and have seen success. I think he hit a home run maybe last night in last night's game. At some point in the Brewers game or the Brewers series, he's starting to make better contact with the baseball, getting those hands through the zone quicker. CJ Cron might not have necessarily opened his starting position a little bit more, but he's starting to plant his leg more open, which is allowing his hands to get through the zone a lot faster. Guys like Randall Grichuk have opened their stance practically by moving their foot in a more open posture as compared to last season. And he, in his return from his rehab from that sports hernia surgery that he had in the offseason, is also starting off very hot. I think he's hitting around 500 in his first few at-bats of the season. And Ezekiel Tovar, yes, our favorite young shortstop, is also doing something similar. He hasn't opened his stance up a ton, But when he has, he's seen success. And I'm not going to spoil too much with Tovar either, because he's another guy we're going to talk about later on this show. But it's just interesting. It's good to see that they're actually taking practical approaches to improving their ability to make contact with the baseball and reducing their strikeout rate and chase rate even. As a result, you know, chase rate would be reduced if you can see the ball out of the pitcher's hand a little bit better by being more open. Nonetheless, let's hop into player number one.
Player number one.
So player number one on today's episode will be Justin Lawrence. Justin has been a fairly highly touted prospect for the Colorado Rockies over the course of his professional career. His current role with the team is as an eighth inning reliever kind of guy. So he's the guy who comes in and sets up the closer, ideally on any given night. His current stats for the 2023 season are as such. He's 1-1 with a 1.65 earned run average in 16.1 innings pitched. He has walked 6 batters, struck out 15. He possesses an ERA plus of 3.12, meaning he is 212 percentage points better than the average MLB reliever. He has a current WHIP of 0.92 and a current FIP of 3.42. Now, I know I just introduced two very new terms to us all here on this podcast, but if you've been following baseball for a little bit, they might not necessarily be as new. But for anyone who might be newer to the sport of baseball and doesn't understand what WHIP or FIP are, let's talk about them really quickly. So WHIP is fairly simple. WHIP. Man, I'm getting mixed up because they rhyme and they're fairly close in verbiage. Nonetheless, WHIP is probably the simpler of the two between WHIP and FIP. WHIP is simply just an abbreviation for walks and hits per inning pitched. It effectively accounts for how many walks and hits a pitcher surrenders in each inning that they pitch. So for Justin Lawrence to possess a 0.92 WHIP, that means that he is giving up fewer than a walk and a hit per inning. And that's actually a good thing. When it comes to major league caliber pitchers, a good WHIP is usually right around one or so. Anything below one is outstanding, obviously, and potentially even Cy Young worthy. But since a good WHIP is around one, something in either direction, whether it's lower or higher by a few points, like 1.1, 1.2 WHIP, is really not bad at all. So that's what WHIP is: walks and hits per inning pitched. FIP is a little bit more complicated, but really not substantially more complicated. All FIP is, FIP stands for fielding independent pitching. And here, according to Fangraphs, Fangraphs is a fairly notable and reliable source for anybody who wants to learn more about baseball. I don't know if they do other sports, but baseball for sure. Fangraphs says that FIP is a measurement of a pitcher's performance that strips out the role of defense, luck, and sequencing, making it more stable as an indicator of how good a pitcher really has performed over a given period of time, more effectively than, say, runs allowed, like ERA. That in particular is an important distinction between ERA and FIP, because when we're talking about FIP, we're talking about taking that defensive aspect out of it in a way that ERA will not account for. ERA will not necessarily say, well, is the defense behind you playing well? Is that why you haven't given up a ton of runs? Or is it because you're actually a good pitcher? FIP is kind of like ERA, but if the pitcher would have experienced league average results in terms of balls in play and league average timing, at least according to Fangraphs. So that's what FIP is. FIP is apparently, bottom line, if you have to take something from that explanation, simply, FIP, fielding independent pitching, is a statistic that is a more accurate demonstration of how good a pitcher really is. And according to the Akron Beacon Journal, a good FIP in baseball would be right around 3. 3 FIP would actually be terrific, according to them. A 4 FIP would be closer to average, and anything approaching a 5 FIP would be considered below league average or just flat out poor. So the fact that Justin Lawrence possesses a FIP of 3.42 shows that he's actually been a pretty good pitcher independent of the defense behind him on any given night. Important to note, But now let's take a look at his pitch summary. Obviously, as we mentioned in the season preview episode, Lawrence works two pitches. He works a slider and a fastball. He uses the slider about 56% of the time, averaging about 84 miles an hour velocity-wise, and he throws the fastball 44% of the time at about 95 miles an hour. And let's take a look at some of his analytic pros. Justin Lawrence has been very good. I mean, obviously, for me reading the stats, that's not hard to tell. But just how good has he been? Well, he's in the red in a lot of important categories. He's in the red in expected ERA, in expected weighted on base percentage, in expected batting average surrendered, expected slugging percentage surrendered. He is in the 92nd percentile in barrel percentage. And he's also just slightly in the red at 57th percentile in strikeout percentage. His fastball velo is in the 79th percentile. And his fastball spin is also in the 57th percentile. So overall, Justin Lawrence has been a very, very good pitcher in terms of the sort of key metrics, so to speak. Some of the cons that Lawrence possesses at the moment would probably be his average exit velo surrendered, his hard hit percentage surrendered, his walk rate, and his whiff rate. All of those are in the blue, the lowest of which being a tie between his whiff rate and his chase rate, both of which are in the 19th percentile. So overall, Justin isn't a perfect pitcher, but he is certainly a very good one and one of the better ones on this Colorado Rockies staff. The overall consensus that I have about him is that he's solid enough to be a contributor to a successful Rockies team, but that's going to mostly be because of his good deception. I don't think he's got the greatest deception from a pitch perspective. His pitches don't necessarily break at major league level. His fastball spin is obviously not a ton above major league average, and I do believe it's not listed here, but I did some further research and I saw that his slider moves a little bit less laterally, and I guess what would that be? Downwardly doesn't sound like the right word. Vertically down than the typical major league pitcher. So his break isn't necessarily out of this world, but his motion is certainly deceptive enough to make up for that lack of break. And that's what my eye test would tell me as well. He's definitely proven to be a trustworthy late inning reliever. That funky delivery is certainly a part of it. He's a guy you can just throw into a game at really the seventh inning, the eighth inning. If you need him to go out and get a save, I definitely trust him to do so at this point in time. That's just how effective he's been. So adjustments for Justin might include just keeping that walk rate low. That's really been his big bugaboo. Walking batters and putting runners on base is not really a good thing, and it's not something that Buddy likes to see out of both his starters and his relievers. So just continuing to lower that walk rate, getting in the strike zone more, trusting that deception with the motion will be very key for Justin to continue succeeding as a Colorado Rocky in his role as the eighth inning setup guy. On to player number two. So player number two is going to be Pierce Johnson. Pierce's current role with the Colorado Rockies is as their closer, given that Daniel Barr started the year off on the 15-day IL. And Pierce, I think, has actually pitched pretty well. Now, these statistics, I forgot to note before I got into Justin Lawrence, these stats aren't updated after after the Brewers game. So none of these stats account for the Brewers game that was played today on this Thursday. I do believe Pierce gave up a run or two in his outing today. But nonetheless, here are his stats prior to today's outing. He's 0-1. He's gotten four saves as the Rockies closer. He's got a 3.97 ERA in 11.1 innings pitched. He has walked seven batters, struck out 17 batters, has an ERA plus of 131, making him 31 percentage points better than the major league average reliever. He has a whip of 1.68. Remember from a little bit earlier that that is walks and hits per inning pitched, which means he gives up about 1.68 walks and hits per inning. And he's got a FIP of 4.51. So a little bit higher than major league average. So when you look initially at Pierce Johnson, and I think after he gave up a few runs today, his ERA ended up being pushed to something like 5.11 or something like that. Initially, you'd look at Pierce and you'd be like, I don't know. I'm not too sure about this guy. Unfortunately, that is why we need more than just the eye test to appropriately assess whether a player is good or not or has potential to be good or not. Pierce works a very solid two-pitch mix. He works a curveball and he works a fastball. The curveball he throws about 62% of the time at 84 miles per hour. The fastball is thrown 38% of the time at 95 miles per hour. But aside from his pitch mix, he has worked really, really effectively. He's in the red in a lot of these categories. Average exit velo, hard hit percentage, expected ERA, expected weighted on base, expected batting average, expected slugging, expected, well, I guess that's the last expected, but barrel percentage, strikeout rate. He is 90th percentile in the league in strikeout rate. That's pretty darn good. His whiff rate, 87th percentile. He's up there. His fastball velo at that 95 miles per hour average, 79th percentile. But what's most notable about this is that he's 94th percentile in the league in curveball spin. And that'll be important. We'll get to that in just a second. Some of the cons he possesses, a lot like other Rockies pitchers, both starters and relievers, is a strugglesome walk rate. All right, 15th percentile in the league in walk rate isn't amazing. Chase rate, he's 22nd percentile as well. So he doesn't get a lot of chases on his pitches. But I think that's fairly explainable. Overall, the consensus I have about Pierce is that he's a good pitcher, but he struggles with visual deception in a way that a guy like Justin Lawrence does not. He's tough to hit, make no doubt about it, as those advanced statistics demonstrate. Most of the time, he is tough to hit, and that is going to be because of his curveball. When you possess a curveball that is 94th percentile in spin rate, which is phenomenal, it's going to be hard to hit. I don't care if it's at altitude. I don't care if it's at sea level. Like we've discussed many times on this show, breaking balls do not break significantly differently at altitude versus sea level. I think curveballs are affected by somewhere between 1 to 2 inches worth of break, which is not really a ton in most contexts. It requires an adjustment on behalf of the pitcher, of course. But I mean, considering the fact that he throws his curveball 62% of the time, that is really what's keeping him as a very, very effective pitcher for this Colorado Rockies team. The walks are really going to kill him, of course. But again, just the fact that he is tough to hit because that curveball makes him tough to hit is a very, very good sign. He does have a simple motion, unlike Justin Lawrence. He is not really deceptive. I wouldn't consider his motion deceptive at all. It's fairly over the top, pretty easy to time up, in all things considered. Like, would you rather have to time up Justin Lawrence with that arm slot, that arm angle that he comes at from that sort of sidearm, three quarters type of angle? Or would you rather time up a guy like Pierce Johnson who comes more over the top with a simpler motion? I think most people would probably pick the latter. So the simple motion does make it a little bit easier to pick up things like his fastball and his curveball, especially given the count that the batter is in. But the only adjustments I think I'd suggest as it pertains to Pierce is just to stay in the zone. I mean, he's got to trust that curveball a little bit more. He's obviously got a good one when it is on, but just staying in the zone, maintaining command, maintaining control, and just doing that, approaching those at-bats from that perspective and trusting that he will get results regardless of really whether he misses by a little bit, misses spot by a little bit in either direction. It doesn't really matter. His curveball is good enough. As long as he gets it in there and isn't putting runners on base, he'll be good. And he also needs to locate that fastball too, right? Because he throws two pitches. That's the other pitch he throws. Most of the time he throws the curveball, which means that the fastball is kind of that two-pitch strike that he goes to frequently. And I've seen several instances this year where he has had like a 1-2 count or a 2-2 count, and he's thrown a fastball up in the zone and it's just barely missed, or sometimes more than just barely missed. So getting control of that fastball, being able to locate that fastball in those two strike counts will be critical for Pierce to maintain his success and to continue lowering those numbers from where they currently are throughout the rest of the season. All right, on to player number three.
Player number three.
Player number three is Brent Suter. Now, Brent had a lot of mixed reactions from Rockies fans and Rockies country when we picked him up off of waivers from Milwaukee, funny enough, during the offseason, in a way that maybe a Pierce Johnson didn't, right? Pierce Johnson, Colorado kid, on a postseason team that he was relied upon in certain circumstances during the postseason last year to get big outs when needed. Brent Suter was not seen as that guy. And coupled with just his profile, which we'll get into in a second, people weren't super positive about him. I will say, though, and you can ask a few people that I know that I talk Rockies baseball with, when we signed Brent Suter, I did say, I do think this is a signing that will be beneficial for a Rockies bullpen that has struggled. I'm not going to give myself entire props for Brent's situation, because once we get into Brent Suter and his numbers thus far this season, it will become very apparently obvious that thus far he has performed in a way that nobody could have expected or predicted. Let's get into it. He's mostly been used as a sixth or seventh inning reliever this season for the Colorado Rockies, kind of that guy who sets up the back end of the bullpen in leads, and a guy who can kind of eat an inning or two if the Rockies are trailing by a few runs in like the fifth or the sixth inning. His stats thus far for the season are as such. He is 0-0 with a 0.98 ERA in 18.1 innings pitched. He has walked 8 batters, struck out 15, good for a 523. You heard that properly. A 523 ERA plus. 423 percentage points better than the major league average reliever with a 0.93 whip and a 3.19 FIP. Brent Suter has hands down been the best reliever in the Colorado Rockies bullpen this season. And I know maybe people who aren't as familiar with Brent Suter won't really understand why this is such a big deal. Well, I'll get into why it's a big deal. Again, if you've listened to this podcast for a little bit and you heard my season preview episode, you'll know exactly why. But for those of you who don't and are newer, here's his pitch summary. He throws a fastball 69% of the time, a changeup 24% of the time, and a slider 6% of the time. Not too bad. It's a good pitch mix. It's a solid pitch mix for a pitcher who pitches at Coors Field in half of his outings, presumably, in theory. His fastball average velocity is 87 miles an hour. His changeup average velocity is 77 miles an hour, and his slider average velocity is 76. Now we're starting to see why this doesn't make sense. All right, there is no way, in theory, again, that a guy with this type of breakdown could not even just be the best reliever on a team, but be one of the best relievers arguably in Major League Baseball. There's just no way. There's just no way that that should be possible. Then we look at his statistics, and he's literally in the red in most of these percentile rankings, and it's not even close. When I say in the red, I mean he is burning red. Average exit velocity, 99th percentile. Hard hit percentage, 100th percentile. He's literally, guys, literally the best in the league in hard hit percentage. He's up there as one of the best in the league in that category. Expected ERA, expected weighted on base, 95th percentile. Expected batting average, 96th percentile. Expected slugging, 99th percentile. Barrel percentage, 96th percentile. This is a good pitcher. This is a really good pitcher, guys. Oh my goodness. This is incredible. Now, obviously, he has some cons, the stats that I didn't mention, which kind of makes him an anomaly, which is why I'm so surprised. His strikeout rate, 41st percentile. He's in the blue. Walk rate. He's in the blue again. 26th percentile. Whiff rate. 22nd percentile. Chase rate. 37th percentile. Fastball velocity. 1st percentile. He's among the worst pitchers in Major League Baseball as it comes to fastball velocity. Well, obviously, he throws 87. Fastball spin, 26th, although that's not really a huge issue for reasons I've stated previously. Again, high spin fastballs at Coors Field, no bueno. So the low spin is a good thing, but it is a little bit lower than we'd obviously like. Overall, the consensus on Brent Suter, he's a great pitcher. This is arguably the best he's ever pitched in his career to start a season. Is this maintainable? Again, I don't know. But overall, right now, the current Brent Suter, who is sitting in the Colorado Rockies bullpen, ready to be utilized at any given moment, is a great pitcher. He overcomes his low velocity. Now, this doesn't seem to make sense, but this is why I think he's actually been able to overcome his low velocity and those other sort of analytic cons that he has with the low strikeout percentage and the walk rate and the whiff rate and the chase rate and the velo and the spin. Well, I just mentioned the velo, I guess, but nonetheless, he overcomes all of those analytic cons with sort of just surprising hitters. It's quite incredible. What my eye test has told me, and I've seen a decent amount of his outings thus far this season, is that Brent mislocates his pitches fairly frequently. Not going to lie, Brent does not have very good command or control. Again, not really uncommon for Rockies relievers. But the only difference is that in a league where pitchers throw fastballs that average around 95 miles an hour, with breaking balls that average somewhere between 86 and 89, and changeups in the low 80s, velocity-wise, when you go to the bullpen and you bring in a guy like Brent Suter, who does none of that, whose fastball is literally the same speed as like the average slider, and it's just really hard to comprehend. But in theory, when you go from a guy who's throwing about 94 to 95, now the Rockies don't have a ton of those guys in their rotation aside from Noah Davis and Ryan Feltner, Seabold kind of can dabble up around 93, 94 occasionally as well. Senzatella too. Nonetheless, I don't care if the guy's throwing 90. If you bring in a guy out of the bullpen who's left-handed, throwing 87 miles an hour with a 77 mile an hour changeup with the funky motion that he has, and believe me, it's funky. It's one of the most funky motions in Major League Baseball. When you put all of those things together, it doesn't really matter that he misses his location. Say he starts a batter off. I think I saw this the other day. He was put in against the Brewers. I think that was the Wednesday night game. He throws first pitch changeup, and I think he missed like middle up or up and in with a 77 mile an hour changeup. And I don't remember exactly what the outcome was, but the batter either fouled it off or swung and missed at it. One of the two. And it was soft contact if there was contact. Bottom line is, you can completely mislocate a pitch, but if it's effectively mislocated, like Brent has somehow found a way to do, effectively mislocating 77 mile an hour changeups, and then not only that, but you speed them up to 87 in certain counts where they're not expecting it, and they just foul that off too or swing through it. I think he missed middle with an 87 mile an hour fastball that was swung through. Granted, the Brewers lineup isn't necessarily known as one of the best lineups in baseball, although they've been better this season. You're missing middle with 87 and you're getting swings and misses? You're clearly doing something right. I don't know what, but you're doing something right. And that is kind of what Brent Suter has benefited from thus far this season. And you know what? If this continues to keep up, I think he can continue to dominate like this. This is incredible because there are really no other relievers. Maybe there are a few, like miscure is maybe the right term. Obscure. That's the word I'm looking for. Thank you. Goodness gracious. The brain is finally tuning in. Obscure pitchers out there in the major leagues who are similar to Brent Suter with this type of build, low velo. Ideally, you're not going to see a Brent Suter on most nights if you're a Major League Baseball team. So when the Colorado Rockies go to their bullpen and they bring in Brent Suter, it's going to be hard to adjust from a guy who's throwing 93 to 96 down to a guy who's throwing 87 with a 77 mile an hour changeup. If he can continue to just improve his command and control and actually pinpoint precisely locate those pitches, he's going to continue to dominate. I don't know if he can continue to have a sub one ERA. He's kind of giving me 2022 Tyler Kinley vibes, who had like a 0.96 to like 25 innings pitched the first half of the year before he needed Tommy John. But Brent Suter, man, Brent Suter, best reliever in the Rockies bullpen as of right now. I can't say that I called that he'd be the best reliever in our bullpen, but I certainly said before the season began that he'd be a very good one. And he's been a very good one, to say the least. All right, we'll cover the two hitters that we're going to talk about on today's episode in just one second. Yet again, stay tuned. Welcome back yet again. Now we're going to get into player number four and our first hitter of today's episode.
Player number four.
All right, so the player that we're going to discuss first is going to be Elias Diaz. Not player, I guess, but hitter. The first hitter we'll discuss is Elias Diaz. His current role with the team has been what it's been over the last three seasons. He is the primary catcher for this Colorado Rockies team. Thus far this season, he's played in 28 games. He's hit three home runs, 14 RBIs driven in on a slash line of .337 batting average, .390 on base percentage, and an .890 OPS. Good enough for an OPS plus of 129. defensively, Elias has a 44% caught stealing percentage, which is good enough for third in all of Major League Baseball among catchers, although he does have three errors attributed to his name as well. So let's go dive into Elias Diaz a little bit further. Elias has a few analytic pros that we can look at. He's in the red in a decent amount of these categories. And given that stat line that I just gave you about his 2023 season thus far, that would kind of make sense. He's in the red in average exit velo, max exit velo, hard hit percentage, expected weighted on base average, expected batting average, expected slugging, and surprisingly, strikeout percentage. 69th percentile in strikeout percentage. So Elias is obviously hitting the ball fairly well. Arguably the best he's hit in his entire career. Now the analytic cons are a little bit strugglesome. His barrel percentage is in the blue, 21st percentile. His walk rate is a little bit lower than we'd like it to be, in the 34th percentile. Whiff percentage, 45th percentile. Chase rate, 19th percentile. And in terms of framing, I don't know how framing is calculated, but they have him in the 43rd percentile of framing. Now, I guess what that would mean is that he's struggling to draw pitches that aren't strikes into the strike zone and make them strikes, which is effectively what framing is. That might agree with what I've seen thus far in terms of umpiring being fairly worse than it has been over the last few seasons. So maybe Elias is just struggling in terms of that. All in all, I think the consensus on Elias is that he's a very solid hitter. He's a very solid catcher, and he has the potential for a career year this year. There's really not a lot that comes to mind when you think of Elias Diaz in years past. Obviously, you think of him as a guy who has power potential. You don't think of him as a high on-base percentage guy, and you certainly don't think of him as a guy who makes fairly soft contact. I know I said that in terms of average exit velo, he's in the 56th percentile, and in terms of hard hit percentage, he's in the 67th percentile. But again, barrel percentage, he's in the 21st percentile. And this is actually a good another learning moment that we can just cover here for a second. There is a difference between hard hit percentage and barrel percentage. I know undoubtedly there's a listener right now going, what is the difference between hard hit and barrel? Well, I will tell you. The difference between a hard hit ball and a barreled baseball, according to the Pitcher's List, which is a website online, I'm assuming they're fairly reputable and a good source to make me correct in this explanation. But the difference between hard hit and barrel percentage is that a hard hit is considered a ball that is hit at 95 miles an hour of exit velocity or more. And for a ball to be considered barreled, the ball must have an exit velocity of at least 98 miles per hour. So 98 miles an hour plus. Overall, that just kind of shows that Elias is hitting the ball pretty well most of the time. I mean, 67th percentile in hard hit, which means that he's among the league leaders in hitting balls over 95 miles an hour, but slower than 98. So I guess that's kind of what it means. There's just that gap there between hard hit and barrel, which is that 95 to 98 is kind of hard hit. And then barrel percentage is anything harder than 98. Elias is not hitting a ton of balls over 98 miles an hour, and a decent amount of home runs occur when you hit baseballs over 98 miles an hour, which simply means that Elias is making fairly solid contact and getting a lot of singles, a few doubles here and there. And I think my eye test would agree with that. I would say, like I mentioned earlier, the open stance has served him well. It has really served him well. It's allowed his hands to be free, and he's been able to put more balls in play and more balls in play hard, even the opposite way. His only problem, really, I think, at this point in time, it's hard to nitpick with a guy who's hitting 337 with 390 on base and an 890 slugging, all of which are above major league average. And obviously his OPS plus is above major league average as well. He's 29 percentage points higher than the average MLB hitter. The only thing that he'd probably need to improve on is that he chases a ton of pitches away, like a ton. Unfortunately, that's an issue a lot of Rockies hitters struggle with, but for whatever reason, Elias has been better than most of them in that using this approach where he just swings with a more free mindset, it's made him one of the best hitters in the league. So, I mean, maybe there's something to that. I know I mentioned on last week's episode that Chuck and KB do need to do something similar. By the way, if you don't understand this thing I'm using, Chuck is Charlie Blackman and KB is Chris Bryant. I did mention that both of those guys need to get back to using a similar approach that Diaz has apparently embodied and just being more of a free swinger and trusting that you can put the ball in play effectively, hitting those gaps and even putting baseballs over the wall. So I do like that Elias has embodied this, and I think it's served him very well. Other than improving his vision at the plate, I think he's perfectly fine the way he is. It's, again, hard to nitpick a guy who has performed this well this season. Again, on pace for a career year if this keeps up, and that would make him arguably one of the best catchers in Rockies history, for that matter. All right, we'll move on and wrap up this episode and this segment of Five-Man Analysis with player number five.
Player number five.
All right, player number five is Ezekiel Tovar, whom we covered a few episodes ago. Ezekiel is a rookie. He's actually the youngest player in all of Major League Baseball, considering that Jordan Walker, who is the only player younger than him, was sent down to the minor leagues a few weeks ago, given the Cardinals' struggles and all that fun nonsense. Currently, Ezekiel is the Rockies' primary shortstop, and thus far in 28 games played, he has hit one home run, driven in 9 runs. He's slashing .219 batting average with a .265 on base percentage and a .598 OPS. Good for a 54 OPS plus, making him 46 percentage points worse than a major league average hitter. And he has also committed 2 errors thus far this season. So it sounds like a prototypical rookie, right? Tovar, according to some experts, came into this season as a guy who could potentially be in the running for rookie of the year. I don't necessarily think that will happen given this start. He'd have to significantly pick up his play in order to put himself in that sort of running. Or maybe he could put himself back in that running. Although Ezekiel has had a very strugglesome start to his career the first month or so, over his last 10 games, he seems to have figured something out. Over his last 10 games, he's slashing .314, hit his first home run at Coors Field, end of the season, second of his career. He's hit 3 doubles and 4 RBIs out of that 8 or 9 spot in the lineup for the Rockies. So he's significantly improved over the last week and a half or so. Overall, my consensus on Tovar is that he has a lot of potential, both offensively and defensively. I think he's in the top few percentiles in the league, rather, in arm strength. Yeah, he is 72nd percentile in arm strength. And in sprint speed, he's in the 79th percentile. So he has good traits that will make him a good defender on that side of the ball. But offensively, I think the potential is also still there. As we saw this week, he hit his first home run. He has home run potential. He has the ability to go gap to gap with his extra base hits as well. I just think he's still working through some of those technical and timing issues, like a lot of other Rockies are, but him significantly more than others. Obviously, there's an adjustment between the minor leagues and the major leagues. And for a guy in general, regardless of when they get called up, it's tough. But for a guy who's 21, like, this is an experience. Being at the major league level is an experience. Even if you are considered one of the more mature, younger players in the league, it is a new experience that requires an adjustment period. So I think Ezekiel is still kind of figuring all of that out. Technically and timing-wise, I do think he has also, like I mentioned briefly earlier, benefited from opening his stance up. It has served him well when he's done it, but it's not fully in his muscle memory yet. And all I have to do is flash back to last night, where Ezekiel, in one of his first at-bats, I think it was actually his first at-bat of the game against Eric Lauer, he started with a more open stance, footwork-wise. His feet, his front foot, his left foot, his plant foot started like a little bit more open than he has had it for most of the season, and it allowed him to get to an inside pitch and get a base hit down the left field line. I was like, all right, that's good to see. And then later on in the game, he went back to sort of a more closed batting stance, the stance that he had been using thus far this season for the majority of the season, and he struck out. Yeah, that wasn't good. He struck out. Overall, what does that mean? It just means that that new technique and some of those new timing things that he's been working on aren't fully in his muscle memory yet, but I think the more he practices it and becomes more aware of it himself, He'll be able to improve his play and continue this trend that he's demonstrated over the last 10 games that he's played. So overall, just continuing to improve that technique and timing and trusting that he does have the potential to succeed at this level will effectively improve the player in the body of Ezekiel Tovar. Overall, in summary for these five players, as it pertains to pitchers, the pitchers just need to get in the zone a little bit more. Even with the good pitchers that we have on the staff, guys like Lawrence, guys like Johnson, Suter, they struggle staying in the zone. Obvious point of improvement there. They need to trust their pitches and their deception, whether that's because of their funky motion or their high spin rate breaking pitches. They just need to trust it, and they need to believe that if they get those pitches in the zone, they will be hard to hit for any batter most of the time. I mean, hitting in general is already really difficult. I don't know off the top of my head or in front of me what the Major League Baseball batting average across the league is, but I'm sure it's not higher than like 250, 260 at most. Like, it's hard. It's hard to hit in the modern day baseball scene. So if the pitchers can get that their pitches in there, especially if they're effective, they will see success. In terms of our hitters, the hitters just need to lower their chasing tendencies. I like the free swinging trends that I've seen. It's better than being more tentative and not swinging at pitches like we've seen guys like Charlie Blackmon and Chris Bryant exhibit over the course of this season in instances. So I take chasing over being too hesitant to swing. But again, you can't swing too much. You can't be chasing breaking balls way out of the strike zone. You can't be chasing breaking balls that are not going to be strikes given the count that you are in. Overall, they just need to lower their chasing tendencies and just register more open stance muscle memory. They just need to develop that muscle memory more. They just need to make it a habit to start with that open stance and allow their hands to continue getting through the zone faster and improve their offensive output in those ways. Other than that, that will be it for this episode of Adjusting for Altitude. Thank you for listening. If you have made it this far, share this with your friends, your family, or anyone else who might be interested in Major League Baseball or the Colorado Rockies. Thank you again, and I will see you all next week. Stay safe, stay cool, and most importantly, go Rockies.
This has been Adjusting for Altitude with Christopher Nelson II. If you are indeed a fan of Colorado Rockies baseball or simply a fan of MLB content, follow this podcast on your favorite podcasting platform and share this podcast with your friends and family. Baseball in Colorado is a complicated situation, but it is certainly not unsolvable. Until our next episode, take care and go Rockies. We'll be right back.